Thank you so much. Appreciate it. All right. I love notes, and I want to introduce you to notes, or maybe you already love them, and I don't have to convince you they are wonderful. So when I started in note investing in 1988, I went to work for someone else. I had like a title and a documentation background, and I went there, and I went, wow, people buy these notes? I lived in a small town up on the Idaho-Washington border, and I went to the big city of Spokane, Washington to find my fortune, and I went to work for this company, and lo and behold, they'd been buying seller finance notes for 30 years already, the gentleman I went to work for. So that's 1988 when I went to work for them. They'd already been doing it for 30 years. So I learned all about notes and how to run the financial calculator, and I was just fascinated by that. And I know I wanted to find my fortune in real estate, but now I wanted notes, but they wouldn't let me buy notes because it was a conflict of interest. And that's understandable. They were afraid I'd pick all the good ones off, right? So I was allowed to buy real estate. And I could buy real estate with seller financing and creative financing. I could sell it that way. I just couldn't buy the notes. So I became a landlord, like a lot of people when they start out in real estate. They buy a property and they rent it out to tenants. I bought a fourplex and I lived in one of the units. They call it house hacking now, right? Back then we didn't have a word for it except for pay your bills on somebody else's money. So I've done that, and then I've seller financed that property. And so I was doing all these seller financing things, but I really wanted to be a note investor. And why do I want to be a note investor? Why notes? Well, if you are someone who likes monthly cash flow backed by real estate, so who likes monthly cash flow backed by real estate? Yeah, that's why we're here. Well, if you like that, but you don't want the hassles of tenants, toilets, trash, termites, 2 a.m. in the morning lockout calls, 10 a.m. on Sunday, topped up toilet calls. People who make payments on notes, they don't call the bank when those things happen, right? They have to figure it out themselves. So that's why I love notes. You get monthly cash flow backed by real estate that we know and like, we can touch and feel, that we don't have the hassles of tenants, toilets, and trash. So that's what we're going to cover today. And I do this through seller finance notes. There are other kinds of notes, and we'll talk about those today, but my specialty is seller finance notes. We're going to talk about how big is that market, why is it good now? There's always been seller financing. I wouldn't still be doing it for 30 plus years if there wasn't still good notes out there. But why is it especially good right now? And why can you convince a buyer or a seller to seller finance? Because you might use this to buy real estate, you might use it to sell real estate, or you might want to invest in the note. So you could do any of the roles on any of the different transactions. I want to talk about five profit strategies that we use regularly with notes, how to build your team so you do it the right way, don't get yourself in trouble, and then 10 steps if you're interested in creating notes. That's the one piece that, Venus, I really want you to focus in on. How do you create notes that protect you as the seller, that are marketable to an investor if you ever want to sell them? So I want to make sure we talk about that. And some of my favorite strategies are leveraging notes with partials and wraparound mortgages. And the reason I love talking about that is people think, and maybe you've thought this or heard this, oh, to get involved in notes, you've got to have all kinds of cash laying around, right? So there are ways to recapitalize. Just like you leverage real estate, you can leverage notes. So how many people here have ever bought a piece of property and got a loan? Anybody bought property with a loan? All right. So you know how you sign a note and a mortgage and you make your payments, right? So all I'm going to do today is just get you on the other side of the cash register where somebody's making payments to you instead of you making payments to someone else. So it's a concept, I swear, that you know and already have experienced. We're just going to talk about experiencing it as a note investor. As a show of hands, has anybody here ever seller financed a property as a buyer or a seller? Ah, we've got a very creative group in here. Excellent. And has anybody ever bought a note from somebody else or made a loan to somebody else? All right, excellent. So we're going to talk about all those strategies today. Sound good? All right. And how to make these notes work for you. Now, I am not an attorney. I'm not a tax advisor. I don't play those on TV, but I have learned a few tricks and tips over the last 30 years, and so I'm going to share this information based on my own personal experience. So let's start at the beginning. What is a note? Well, a note is just a promise to pay. It's like, I promise to pay you X dollars over time at this interest rate. We're familiar with notes, dollar bills are notes. A check is a promise to pay. It's a negotiable instrument. If you go get a car loan, you'll sign a note secured by the car. And if you get a loan on property, you're going to sign a promise to pay, and it's going to be backed by a mortgage or a deed of trust on the real estate. And that's the kind of notes we're talking about today. Yes, you can do unsecured notes. You could do notes on boats, cars. I've done a wraparound note on a boat one time. I mean, there's all kinds of creative strategies, but today we're talking about notes backed by real estate because that's something we can touch and feel as a note holder. So traditionally, if Barb the buyer went out to buy a piece of property, she would sign a note to the bank, and that note would say how much she owed, what's the payment, what's the interest, how long she had to repay it. And if Sam the seller was selling the property, and we're going to go back to Sam the seller and Barb the buyer a lot today because we're going to see them in different places in a transaction, and we can always think, okay, Sam the seller has this real estate investment property he had. He's tired of being a landlord. He decides to sell the property. He wants to cash in on some of that appreciation. He doesn't want the headaches of tenants anymore, and so he is offering it to sell to Barb the buyer. Traditionally, Barb the buyer would go to the bank and get a loan, and Sam the seller would give Barb the buyer a deed, and then Barb the buyer would sign that note, and she would give a mortgage or a deed of trust, depending on your state, to the bank. And Sam the seller gets his monies out of the picture, and Barb the buyer just makes her payments to that bank every single month. And that's just a traditional bank transaction. So what's seller financing? Well, in seller financing, Sam the seller just becomes the bank. He agrees to accept payments from Barb the buyer over time. He gets a note and a mortgage or a note and deed of trust just like the bank. So he gets a down payment, and then he gets his monthly payments, and he gets interest from Barb the buyer. And he has the same rights as the bank. Barb the buyer still gets to enjoy the property. She can live in it. She can rent it out. She has to pay taxes and insurance. She has to perform maintenance on the property. Sam the seller's like the bank. He gets his payments every month with the principal and the interest. And if Barb doesn't make her payments, then Sam the seller can foreclose and take the property back just like a bank could. All right? So that's the kind of seller finance notes we're going to talk a lot about. And we call this, a lot of people call this mailbox money. Honestly, now everybody uses third-party servicers, so it's really an automatic deposit, but it still sounds fun to say mailbox money, right? So where do we find these notes? Well, seller financing is one of the main places we find these notes. That's where the seller agrees to be the bank and accept payments over time. You can go out and find people who've seller financed and buy their note. You can also create your own notes. So we have a lot of investors that convert a property to notes through seller financing. Or you could lend money. You could get in on a deal by lending money or buying a piece of a note. And the third type of paper we see as note investors is bank-originated paper. We don't see a lot of this. When banks make loans, they usually sell them off on Wall Street in a security. And then you get a letter 2 weeks later after you get it saying, now make your payments over here. So banks do that, and they don't normally sell loans off to private investors like us here in this room, except when something doesn't go right. So what we saw after 2008 were a lot of subprime loans that went into default that came on the market, and people bought those non-performing notes and tried to make them re-performing. We don't see as much of that paper right now. That's because a lot of that is washed through the system, and what's left is just a little bit tired and picked over. Some people think we're going to have another wave of foreclosures and non-performing notes. Maybe we will. I think now we have a lot of people with equity. We probably won't see as much of that. But I rest assured, we've been buying seller finance notes since 1988, and we don't need the non-performing notes to have a very viable note investing business. But like all markets, things come and go. So I think the non-performing, most of the non-performing note markets kind of cleaned itself out, and what's left over is you got to pick through it very carefully. So today we're talking about that seller finance note market, either what exists or what you might want to create as a creative financing specialist. So how big is this market? Well, it happens in every state, and last year we tracked these numbers, for probably 15 years we've been tracking them. There was $22.5 billion with a B of seller financed paper created. That's a pretty big number. We just need a little slice of that pie to have a nice niche in the real estate investing community. And this is not an anomaly. There were $123 billion over the last 5 years. So that typically is a pretty consistent number. Now, if we look at that, that was dollar volume. We can also look at that as counts. And this goes through 2009 to last year. And we can see that by count, because dollar volume changes, right? As real estate gets more expensive, it makes sense dollar volume goes up. But we look at counts, and we saw after 2008, when it was really hard to get a loan, that there was quite a bit more seller financing happening. And then it sort of leveled off. But remember, last year and the year before, when rates were really low, and the year before when rates were really low, not this year, before when they were really low, we still had consistent amount of seller financing, and that's when it was easy to get a loan. So what do you think happens when it's harder to get a loan? There's more seller financing. So it's a good time to learn about it. Seller financing covers all kinds of property. So out of that $22 billion, there is a certain percentage of that was residential, about 52% of it. Commercial, about 25%. Land, there was a lot of seller financing on land. That was about 15% of that $22 billion. And there's always a little bit that the counties don't tell us what the property type is in the data dump that we get. So it usually equals out to about the same kind of ratio. So as a note investor, you can think about whether you want residential, land, commercial, mixed use, mobile home land. You have a choice of what kind of notes you might be interested in. I love to think about what's my market. So when we look at all the seller financing, we divide it into mom and pop, the people that just do one seller finance deal a year. Maybe they only do one in their lifetime. And then we like to see who's doing two or more deals in a year. And that breaks down to about 85% of people that seller finance only do one in a year. And about 15% do two or more deals in a year. I like to focus most of my efforts on that 15%. So I just keep niching down because I find the people that are creating notes often, they'll bring me repeat business. And I can also help them structure a deal so it's more marketable on the secondary market. Now, I also deal a lot with that 85% who just do one deal. But boy, do they bring me some funny notes. You know, they bring it 0% interest, and I only have to make 5 payments a year. And we see some crazy stuff, and we can buy it, but it's the discount that we have to buy it at is not very favorable for them. So if I can really work with the 15% of people that are learning how to structure these notes, then we can get good, viable paper where they don't have to take much of a discount. And in that 15%, there's some people that do four or more notes. That's 7% of the whole. And there's about 8% that do just 2 to 3. The other reason we track this, as we'll talk about later, is because of Dodd-Frank, too. And we like to see where people fall in those ratios. And I promise I'll talk more about that coming up. So what's happening in 2023? Well, what way are interest rates going? Up, and now they're kind of holding, right? But they've gone up, no doubt about it. It's much harder to get financed. The interest rates play into that because your payment's more when your interest is higher. And also banks are just getting more particular on what kind of deals they'll lend on. We have inflation and economic uncertainty. And we also have home sales in a lot of areas that are slowing down. So when all of this happens, the Mortgage Bankers Association tells you what's happening in the economy based on mortgage credit availability. So this is a chart, and I promise I got one more chart and we won't do any more. But the Mortgage Bankers Association said, hey, how easy is it to get a mortgage loan on a house? And back in 2017, 18, 19, it was really easy. It was that 185 means it's really easy to get a loan. And then what happened in 2020, the end of 2019, first part of 2020, you see that big drop. Well, that's when COVID hit and banks pulled back and they started tightening up what they would lend on. And then we see it dropped again in 2022, and that's when mortgage rates went up. So now we're sitting at about 96% of mortgage availability from a bank. The last time it was that hard to get a loan from a bank was back in 2012. 2012 is what happened after the 2008 subprime mortgage meltdown, right? The Great Recession. So we're not in this Great Recession, but we are in this time where it's tight for getting credit from banks. And what we've seen after doing this for 30 years is that when it's hard to get a loan from a bank, that's when seller financing starts to go up. So I kind of married those two charts together so you could see that when it's hard to get a loan, there's more seller financing, and it always lags a little bit behind. But I'm saying that to you because if you've just sort of ignored seller financing in the past, maybe it's just time to open your mind and say, hey, this is a good time to learn about it. So we're going to go back to our example, and we're going to fill in some numbers because now we want to know, how do we make money on this transaction? So we have Sam the seller here, and he's going to sell his property to Barb the buyer for $200,000, and she's going to put $40,000 down. And she's going to owe $160,000, and Sam the seller is going to be the bank. So she's going to become the property owner, and he's going to become the note holder. And she's going to pay interest to him. In this example, 9.75% for 30 years. That means her payment's going to be $1,374.65. Now, we've all gone to get a loan. I think everybody raised their hand. You've signed that disclosure statement that says, if you take 30 years to pay back your loan, how much money are you going to pay back in 30 years? So in this example, if she paid back $1,374 for 30 years, she paid back $494,000 to Sam the seller. Remember, she only borrowed $160,000. So that difference between $160,000 and $494,000 is all interest. That's $330,000 in interest. So Sam the seller is getting 9.75%. That's better than cap rates on most rental real estate, and he doesn't have to pay taxes, insurance, and hassle with that. Now, my hardcore real estate investors, and I think real estate has a great place in your portfolio, and I think notes has a great place in your portfolio. They're going to say, yeah, but you don't get the depreciation or the appreciation. And that is true. When you're a note investor, you don't get depreciation because you don't own the property. And you don't get the benefit of appreciation because you don't own the property. You get the benefit of a safer note. So as note investors, we have to figure out, okay, how do we compensate for that? How do we make up for that? So we have a couple of different ways that we do that. And we'll talk about those today, which happen to be partials and putting them in your self-directed retirement account. All right, so we have this transaction where Sam the seller is happy selling to Barb the buyer and getting his interest. So why do seller financing transactions exist? I think there's three main reasons. Your buyer has an issue, your property has an issue, or your seller's doing it as an investment strategy. So these reasons matter because you might be a buyer or a seller or somebody wanting to do it for investment purposes. So why would Barb the buyer want to finance with seller financing? It's pretty easy to see why buyers want to. They don't have costly loan fees. They don't have private mortgage insurance premiums because banks charge that if it's less than 20% down. We don't have that in seller financing. They can negotiate favorable terms on interest rate. They can do delayed payments. We see a lot of seller financing to investors that want 6 months before they have to start making their payments because they're rehabbing the property. And there's less restrictive underwriting. So if you ever run into a situation where there's down payment issues, credit score issues, proof of income, self-employment income, been on a job less than 2 years, maybe they have debt-to-income ratios, they have a lot of properties financed, usually over 4 or 5. These are all reasons that a bank might not make a loan to a buyer. It's about 50% of buyers who don't qualify for a bank loan. That number moves around, but that's about the average. And about half of those need to get their financial affairs in order before they can buy a house. But I would say about half of that, about 25%, are viable buyer candidates. They just have a little hiccup. We call them penalty box buyers because they just don't fit in that banker's box, but they're still a really good credit risk, a good person to sell a home to. And so that's sort of our ideal buyer that might have just fell out of the banker's box. And we also see a lot of seller financing on non-recourse deals. If you're buying out of your self-directed retirement account, you know you can't personally sign for the loan, and so that's considered non-recourse. The only recourse is the real estate, and we see a lot of seller financing on those deals too. So we know where Bob the buyer might want to seller finance. What about Sam the seller? Well, when it comes to the property, if Sam the seller owns a property that has a challenge that a bank won't lend on, that might be a good candidate. We see this a lot where I moved from Washington, Idaho area in 2000 to Florida, and we see a lot of mobile home and land in Florida. We see a lot of it in Texas and a lot of other states too. So any kind of property that's a little bit harder to finance, if it has excessive acreage, a home on a lot of land, a property that needs rehabbed or fixed up, all those can be hard to finance through a bank. That might make Sam the seller be willing to offer seller financing. We also see properties that are affordable, that are under $100,000 or $150,000, that are hard to finance through banks. And so that tends to be a lot more of an average. I think the average seller finance deal was $250,000 last year. That was a big jump up. It used to be more like $175,000. But what we've seen is as prices have risen everywhere, that the average dollar volume of seller financing is going up too. If you work with real estate, is anybody in here a real estate agent? Yeah. Okay, so when a property is slow to sell, it's been on the market 90 days, it's one of the first strategies that you use is to lower the listing price. Oh, it's not moving. We priced it wrong. Well, if you see a property that's been on the market for over 90 days, that's a really good time to think about seller financing because you could buy it at without them lowering the price if you can negotiate creative terms. So that's one of the areas we often, when we're working with real estate agents, will say, hey, if you've got a listing that's slow to move 90-plus days, before you lower the price, why don't we talk about adding to the listing seller will carry or seller will finance, owner financing available, and you'll get a lot more prospective buyers. You'll open up that buyer pool. Another reason sellers might finance is holding time. If they bought the property and they haven't held it for very long, some banks won't make a loan on it. It could be a distress sale, a state, divorce, any of those sort of situations. So all those types of situations that are a little bit more unique are good times to think about creative financing. So how about a seller? Why would a seller do it if he didn't have to? He might do it, he or she might do it, because it's a well-thought-out investment strategy. We find that sellers who sell with owner financing can usually get about a 10% premium on the sales price. So rather than lowering the sales price, they might actually be able to get more than that. We see that 10% is kind of the general rule of thumb. You can't go over much more than that because it probably won't appraise out. And we don't want to put our buyer borrower into a property where they're underwater, where they owe more than what the property is worth. As we mentioned, there's more prospective buyers. So Sam the seller might want to open up to a bigger pool of buyers if a property is slow to move. And one reason is something called the installment sale tax provision. So the IRS has a code. It's section 453, publication 537. Your accountant or CPA will know about this. But if you own an investment property and you go and sell it and it's appreciated in value, you get to use your basis and your expenses. But if you sell it, you're going to have capital gains tax, right? So the installment sale tax provision in the IRS code says that you can defer the capital gains over the life of the loan that you're accepting payments on. So you don't have to have that big hit of a tax bill in capital gains. So this is great tax estate strategies for investors who own a lot of real estate. They would like to sell some of it, but they don't want to take the big hit, and they want to sell it with seller financing, and then they can just defer that capital gains over the life of that seller financed deal. Sam the seller might do it for long-term interest income. We saw that difference between what Barb the buyer borrowed and what she paid back over 30 years. And these are really great for self-directed retirement accounts. And the reason they're so great for self-directed retirement accounts is you, one, don't have to have that income taxed, because it's interest income if you own it outside your retirement account. It's like interest income, ordinary income. But when you do it inside a retirement account, then it's either tax-free or tax-deferred, and that money can continue to compound on there. So we really like them for retirement accounts also because it's really hard to provide a service to your retirement account on a note. What does that mean? If you're a rehabber of property, you're not supposed, and it's owned by a retirement account, you're not supposed to be in there swinging hammers and rolling paint and doing work, because you're providing a service. And so with notes, they're really hands-off. You just do the investment analysis up front, and you place them with a servicing company that collects the payments. So you don't have to worry about having that problem of crossing the line with notes. And you can have velocity with a note. I can manage a whole lot more notes than I can a piece of real estate, so I can own more and have that money working for me. And then I can leverage them. I can recapitalize. Just like you get loans on property, you can get loans on notes. You can use partials, and we're going to talk about wraps. So let's go back to our example. I guess keep weaving this back in. Do we have any questions so far before we move on? All right, good. Okay. What if Sam the seller says, I don't want to wait 30 years for Barb the buyer to pay me. I got another deal I'd like to do. Well, Sam the seller could sell his note to a note investor like myself or anybody out here who wants to buy a note. But then he's going to take a discount. So what is a more creative strategy where he could get some capital out of it, still own part of that note? Well, we call this the partial purchase. And this is where you're buying a portion of the payments over time. So Sam the seller says, you know, I'd really like to get some money out of this. So I would like to raise $100,000 on this note. Barb the buyer owes me, remember, $160,000 at 9.75. She's going to pay for 30 years. I'd like to get $100,000. And a note investor like myself said, I'll pay you $100,000 if you give me the rights to the next 10 years of payments. And then Sam the seller, when I get my 10 years of payments, the note goes back to you and you can have the last 20 years of payments. Now, what happens on an amortization schedule? At the very beginning, Barb the buyer is paying mostly interest, right? And she doesn't really start paying more principal till about halfway through that amortization schedule. So in 10 years, Barb the buyer is still going to owe $144,925. So Barb the buyer, so I give, so let's think about what Sam the seller gets. He got $40,000 of down payment money. He gets a note for $160,000. He sells 10 years of payments to me, a note investor, for $100,000. So now he's got $140,000 in his pocket. Now, in 10 years, Barb will still owe, after I receive 10 years of payments, $144,925. Note goes back to Sam. He's still collecting $144,925. He mostly sold off interest. That's mostly what he did. He got $100,000 by selling off the next 10 years. He still has $144,925 left. So that's the power of a partial, because it uses that interest that's all up front. And then Sam the seller could sell some more payments, or he could just go back to collecting those payments. Now, a lot of times people have tons of questions on a partial, so we're going to circle back on another example on the partial, I promise. It's just planting seeds right now. All right, and then we're going to deep dive a little more. All right, so one more example. So far, We just assumed Sam the seller owned that piece of property free and clear. Isn't that nice to own property free and clear? Except that when you leverage, you can get your money out there working harder for you. So Sam the seller didn't now own this property free and clear. He still owed money to a bank. So when he sold it to Barb the buyer, he still owed $151,197 to the bank. He was a lucky guy. He got a 4% rate from the bank. He doesn't want to pay that off. When are we going to see 4% again? It's going to be a few years. So he's paying 4% to the bank, and he owes them $763.86. And he owned it for a while as a rental, so he doesn't have 30 years left on his note. He's got about 324 months left. So he's going to sell it to Barb the buyer, subject to his bank loan. Lots of people in here know what a subject to is. When I say wrap, they're like, oh, I don't know what a wrap is. I'm like, yeah, you know what a wrap is. It's just a subject to with some extra paperwork. Why do we do this? Well, the reason that Barb the buyer buys it from Sam the seller on a wrap is because Sam the seller wants to be sure that payment gets made to the First Position Bank. And Sam the seller has some equity in there that he wants to protect. So here's how we do this transaction. It looks just like the one we've already talked about, except has a little bit different paperwork. Sam the seller still gives Barb the buyer a deed. She gives back to Sam the seller a note and a mortgage, except that paperwork says, hey, when Barb the buyer pays her $1,374.65, Sam the seller promises to send off to the bank $763.86. And every month, then, Sam the seller gets the difference, $610.79. That $610.79 is the difference between what he owes the bank and what Barb owes him. It's also the difference between he's paying 4 and she's paying 9.75. There's a lot of opportunity right now with First Position Bank loans that are running at 2.75, 3, 4%. To wrap those with a higher interest rate. I love wraps over subject twos because I feel like all parties are protected that way. We set this up with a servicer so that when Barb the buyer makes her $1,374 payment to the servicing company, before they send the payment to Sam the seller, they send that payment to the bank. And then they send that difference, $610.79, to Sam the seller. So my personal preference to do these as subject twos as wraps. And all that does is it discloses to everyone what happened. So it says, hey, as long as Barb the buyer makes her payment, Sam the seller makes his. Taxes and insurance get paid by Barb the buyer. They flow through to the bank. And if Barb the buyer misses her payment, Sam the seller can still make his payment and foreclose on Barb. If Barb makes her payment, we know it's getting made to the bank because the servicer does that. But if for some reason that doesn't happen, Barb the buyer could make the payment to the bank and reduce what she owes to Sam the seller. So the cool thing is about doing them as wraps is that they all get protected. Depending what state you live in, they might not be called a wrap. It might be called an all-inclusive trust deed. Have you ever seen the initials AITD? That's very popular in California and some other states. It's the same principle. In Florida, we call them wraparound mortgages. So I like these. This is, if you know, last night when they talked about if they put you in a, if you lost everything that you owned and all you had was your knowledge and you had to rebuild your wealth, in this current environment as a note investor, I would do more wrap deals because you can make money just off the spread without an increase in value, just by paying 4 and earning 9 or 10. So usually when we talk about wraps, people say to me, well, what if the bank calls it due? It's a really good question. Because most banks, when they make loans, they say if you transfer your interest in the property, that they can call it due and you have to pay them off. So doing this for 30 years, here's what I have found happens in reality most of the time. As long as you make your payments on time, you don't get behind. As long as you pay your taxes, the real estate taxes, and they don't get behind. And as long as you keep the property insured for hazards, so if something happens to it, the bank is covered, they're happy. They just want their payments. They want to know taxes and insurance are covered. Because most banks sell their loans off to a security, and they've just got a servicer that's collecting those payments. Now, if it gets behind, they're definitely going to call it due. The other thing you have to think about, and this is something that's a fair question, what if the banks get smart and wake up one day and go, I don't like having all this money out 4%. I'd rather loan it out at today's rate of 8 or 9. And that let's go find all the deals where our borrower has transferred title. That is, potentially could happen. I don't think they'll do it, but it's a fair argument to make. So what could we do in that situation? Well, Sam the seller could sell his note to a note investor and pay off the underlying. And we'd pay off the underlying debt, and then he would walk with his equity. So there are solutions to the problems. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying those problems don't exist. Some people don't like wraps because they just don't sleep well at night worrying if the bank's going to call it due. And I say, that's okay, don't do those deals. Yeah, that's all right. But if you're a creative thinker and you're willing to do the proper paperwork, those are really great opportunities in today's environment. Yes?
How does the servicer make money and who pays that?
Great question. So we'll talk a little bit about servicing too here, but the servicer is a third-party servicer licensed in the state where the property is located, and they charge a monthly servicing fee. It usually runs about $30. They're not expensive as a property manager, thank goodness. But it usually runs about $30. And if you're setting these up from the beginning, you can have Barb the buyer make the additional $30 servicing fee. So we're all used to PITI, principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. Well, as note sellers, we like PITIS, which is principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and the servicing fee. Because if it wasn't set up that way at the beginning, then you, the note investor, will end up paying that. So you just have to realize your monthly net payment's going to be that $30 less. Good question. All right, so how do we make money as note investors? So if I want to buy a note, I can go find a note, and I can refer it to a note investor and earn a referral fee. I don't have to have any money. It's just like all the things you do with real estate, you can do with notes. So if you found a piece of real estate and you wholesaled it and you signed your option agreement, you can do that with a note. The average fee we see is about 3% to 6% of the amount invested on referring a note. So if you're starting out and you're saying, oh, notes are cool, but I don't have money to go buy a note, if you're a good marketer, you can find these notes and refer them for a fee. Strategy number two, you can buy a note and hold it for the interest income. So in this case, Sam the seller created a note and held it for the interest income. Strategy three is you can buy part of a note. And we're going to get into these again because wraps and partials as a note buyer are my two favorite things. You can also buy all of the note and sell a partial. The goal is to get whole when you do that, so all the payments riding on the back end are owned free and clear without any dollars invested. And then you can create notes, and that's what we're talking a lot about today, creating notes and using any of these strategies here. So as a note investor, I can go out and look for those people, that $23 billion that was created last year that already created a note so I don't have to go create one. Or I can find a piece of property and create one. So if I want to find the people who already did it, I just do all the normal marketing methods. I do referrals, networking, we go online. You can buy a list of note holders that seller financed from a list provider. You can direct mail them. We call people that say they'll sell a property with owner financing. We do online ads. There's note listing sites now. There's companies that sell notes. I saw a company here. I don't know them personally, but I saw a note company here selling notes. Or you can create the notes. Yeah, you had a question.
Could you please give an idea how do you figure out the referral fee to refer the note?
Yeah, the referral fee back to that strategy one is usually 3% to 6% of the amount invested. We quote what we'll pay. Most note investors will quote what you pay. You deduct your fee, and you make your offer for less. It's kind of like a wholesale deal. You can make a little bit of a spread that way. And then at closing, when the note seller gets funded, then your commission also gets funded.
Do I create a note, or it's basically like real estate agent, like note agent?
Yeah, it's very similar to a note agent. Yeah, so if you wanted to find someone who already held a note and refer it to an investor, they'd pay the referral fee. If you are creating your own note, you don't really pay yourself a referral fee, right? You're going to make your money off the buy of the property, create the note, and then the sell of the note. Yeah, yeah. So people always say, what's the best way to find notes? Well, it really depends. It depends on whether you want to invest, refer, or a combination of both, what your strengths are, what your marketing budgets are, and also what's your time availability. So we actually have a whole training class on marketing for notes for people who want to market to existing note holders, and we do things, we have letters and postcards and ebooks and all these things that we include in our marketing kit that people can change and just put their name on. And that's one strategy, is to market to existing note holders. What we want to talk a little bit about today, though, is creating the notes, because most everybody in here is a real estate investor, and so they want to know, how can I get involved with creating notes? So if you want to start to create a note, most people say, I'd love to create a note, but what's the best terms to put on a note? They want to say, hey, if I create this note, what are you going to pay me if I decide to sell the note? And then I say to them, well, that depends. What are the terms of the notes? What's the creditworthiness of the borrower? I've bought notes at 50 cents on the dollar. That's a horrible discount. Nobody in here wants that. And I've bought notes at 95 cents on the dollar, only a 5% discount. That doesn't sound so bad, right? So how do we make a note that's most desirable to a note investor? Well, these are my ideal terms. I know all the notes don't fit this, and we have lots of solutions for notes that don't fit this, but if you want the best price for a note, you want Barb the buyer to put 20% down. You'd like her to have a credit score of 680 or more, but 600 is sort of the floor. Or she could have no credit score. I'd rather see no credit score than a bad credit score. We like to see 9 to 10% interest, provided that it's allowed by your state. Some states set a maximum amount of interest that can be charged. They use the fancy word usury because it sounds like you're doing something bad, you're using them. So just make sure when you, if you create a note, you talk to your attorney in your state to be sure you're not over the usury law. But ideally, right now in this market, we like about 9 to 10% interest. And we like to see it, if Barb the buyer is going to live in the property, we like to see a 20 to 30 year amortization schedule. If Barb the buyer is not going to live in the property and she's going to rent it out, then it's lucrative to put in a 5 or a 10 year balloon. Right? Then we'll talk about why we suggest different things. All right, so now we're saying, well, that seems like, and I say it too, like, well, if she had 20% down and a 680 credit score and she's paying 9 to 10%, well, why didn't she just get a bank loan? That's a fair question.
Self-employed.
Yeah, that's right. Who's our ideal person? Self-employed buyers. Yeah, all of us in this room are our ideal customer. So somebody who's a good creditworthy risk, but just for some reason falls outside of that bank box. Yeah.
So with a deal like that,
yeah.
Is there a
great question. So he's saying, if I want to sell that note, seasoning means how many months of payments need to be made before a note buyer will buy it. Everybody's a little different. Almost all note buyers want one payment made. They want the transaction to close and the deal to get recorded, and they want at least one payment made to the seller. And the reason they want that is they want to preserve that structure of seller financing. They don't want it to look like they were making a loan. And we'll talk in a minute about why that is. If the credit's good, I know a lot of institutions you could sell this paper to after 1 month of seasoning. If the credit's not good, or if it needs a little bit of work, then it's going to be 6 to 12 months of payments before you're going to get top dollar on it. That's a good question. So what people learn the strategy, they think it's really cool because they think, I'm going to go out and negotiate a deal for 0% interest rate. And that's really great if you're the buyer. It's not so great if you're the seller. So just remember what hat you have on. If you're a buyer and you can get the seller to agree to 0%, that's great. But if the seller needs to sell that note, it's not so great. So this is what note buyers do when you bring us a note, when we price it. We say, all right, I look at this deal and I think I'd like on that deal a 10% yield. So I'm going to put in my financial calculator that payment stream. We've got 9.75 at 13.74 months at 65 cents. And I know that goes for 30 years and the balance starts out at 160. And if I want to make 10% yield based on time value of money, then what can I pay? Well, in this example, boy, excuse me just a second. I got a little bit of a, this wants to fall off. There we go. I think I'm there. Okay. If you brought me this note and I wanted to earn 10% yield, I could pay $156,642. Now remember, the note balance is $160,000. So if I was willing to make 9.75 on that 9.75 note, what could I pay? $160,000. Because I want to make more, I want to make 10%, I'm going to pay less than the note's balance. So every note has an unpaid principal balance. We call it UPB in the note business. So at this point in time, if a note had a $160,000 balance and I wanted a 10% yield, I could pay $156,642. If Barb the buyer and Sam the seller agreed to let her pay 9% interest, her payment would go down, right? Because her interest is lower. So she would pay $1,287.40, and I, as a note buyer, would discount that to $146,699. If she negotiated a 7% rate, she'd only have to pay $1,064 a month. But now, as a note investor, to get my 10% yield, I can only pay $121,000 298 for that $160,000 note. So you see which way this is going, right? If she paid 5%, if the note was written at 5%, her payment would go down to $858.91, and I would pay $97,874. And if she was so lucky to talk Sam the seller into no interest on that note, she'd only have to pay $444 a month, but I could only pay $50,644 for that note. So do you see how interest rate matters? It matters a lot to note investors. So we look at what yield we want and how much of an investment to value we want. Yeah? Yeah. I use 10% because it's pretty typical of what a note buyer would want. Yeah. Now let's just clear our minds for a second and think about this in a different way. Remember when we were talking about wraps and all that low interest rate money that's out there? So let's say there was a note out there for 5%. It's probably really 4%, a lot of these notes. But at 5% on $160,000, the payment's only $858.91. If you took that same $160,000 and wrapped it at 9.75, look at the difference between $1,374 and $858. Right? It's over $600 almost. So remember that example of Sam the seller had a wrap? So think, even if you found a property and you could buy it, and even if you resold it at the same price, you could make a spread off of it if you could wrap that lower interest rate. So just keep that in mind as you see deals out there, as you run into sellers that are trying to sell their property that have that underlying debt. That's a good way to just find another strategy. You might be able to pay their full asking price if they give you good terms. So if you're thinking, hey, I would like to build my team, you're going to work probably with real estate agents. Believe it or not, most seller finance deals I see, there's a real estate agent involved. And yes, there are some deals out there for sale by owner, and that's great if you market to off-market properties. But a lot of deals we see are real estate agents. So normally, the real estate agent is going to want to get paid, right? That's fair. So one of two things needs to happen. A real estate agent can get paid if there's enough down payment money that comes in from Barb the buyer to pay the real estate agent fee. But sometimes, depending on the market you're in, we've had real estate agents agree to take back a second for their real estate fee. And they get a second lien secured by the property, And yes, they do have to wait for payments over time, but the cool thing is they get interest on it, because we're not going to expect them to take back their fee for no interest. So if they're willing to roll some of their fee into a cash flow, they could actually get a second on a piece of property. I'll be honest, we don't see that as much as we used to. It used to be very popular, but I project as we see values starting to flatten out and people trying to sell, and there's less spread in there between what they can sell the property for and what they owe, that we might see more real estate agents start to be willing to take back seconds. It would be better than them lowering their fee, right? A lot of real estate agents would agree to lower their fee if it is skinny. So either there needs to be enough down payment to pay the real estate agent, or the real estate agent might consider working with that as a second on the deal. So you're going to have an attorney and a closing agent to do the paperwork, whatever's customary in your state. I think everybody should do title insurance. I said this in the presentation the other day. One thing, if Tracy could tell everybody, is please, as a note investor, get title insurance. We see lots of seller finance deals where they didn't get title insurance, and you just don't know what problems exist without title insurance. I hate paying for title insurance just as much as you do. But it's a necessary thing to make sure the transaction's insurable. The nice thing is if you do this at closing, you can get an owner's policy for the buyer and a lender's policy on the seller finance note for a reduced rate. And then when you go to sell it, you've got that nice lender's policy there. And you can get Barb the buyer to pay that fee at closing. Then you don't have to pay it later or pay it when you take a discount. You're going to want your accountant or CPA involved if you're thinking about capital gains, or if you're putting it in an IRA, you're going to want your self-directed IRA custodian. And now we come to the mortgage loan originator, MLO, or RMLO, which is a residential mortgage loan originator, actually plays a role in seller financing. You're thinking, I'm doing all this so I don't have to work with a mortgage broker. But these are licensed mortgage professionals that understand seller financing that will qualify your buyer has the ability to make that payment. In 2014, something called the Dodd-Frank Act came along, and they made all kinds of rules for loans that apply to buyers who live in the property. So if you're selling to a buyer that lives in the property, it's possible Dodd-Frank applies. They did make some exemptions for seller financing. They said if you do 1 in 12 months, there's this exemption. If you do 3 in 12 months and you're an entity, there's this exemption. But you still got to make sure they have the ability to repay. And so instead of trying to figure all that out, the simple solution is use a mortgage loan originator to have them get a credit application and verify the income on Barb the buyer. And they will charge a small fee for that. But you get to pass the fee on to Barb the buyer, and you don't have to pay it. And now you know that is in compliance with Dodd-Frank. And the other cool thing is you have a note that's more valuable to a note investor like me because you papered it up so it looks all pretty with an MLO package. And yes, it's an extra step. Let me tell you, in 2014, when this came along, I'm like, that's it. I'm only doing investor deals. I'm not dealing with owner-occupied anymore. The sky is falling. It's going to ruin my career. How am I ever going to buy another note? And really, we just figured out how to do it. We just get compliant with an MLO. Downside is it costs a little more. We pass that along to Barb the buyer. Unfortunately, the law that was supposed to protect her is making her pay more. But as investors, we want to be sure we're compliant. So I think that's a very important piece. If you want a tip, there is a company called CallTheUnderwriter.com. And they will underwrite seller finance deals in all 50 states. And if you're in some states where this is super popular, like Texas, you can probably find 10 of them in our directory. But in some states, it's a little harder to find them, so Call the Underwriter will do that as well. So that's an important factor of it. Yeah?
What should you expect in the way of the cost
of working with an MLO? So the MLO, what costs, I'll say the question so people can hear it, what costs are involved? Call the Underwriter has a two-step program. If you just need a certificate that says they have the ability to repay because you're that three and under, I think it's around $500 or $600. If you want a full MLO package that they stamp their NMLS license number on it, they charge a small percentage of the deal. Well, I think around, I think it's under 1%. They have some negotiation there that they can do. And that it can also be passed on to Barb the buyer. Yeah. Some people become MLOs themselves. I don't want to do that. So I'd rather pay somebody, but that is certainly an option. All right, so we are going to create this note, and how does that work? Well, if you're selling a piece of property, you want to identify your team members and keep them involved. We already know who our team members are. We want to think about the sales price and the initial terms. We're going to market that property with owner financing, maybe on Facebook or the MLS. We are going to pre-qualify any buyers to just roughly make sure that they have the ability to make that payment before we go get the MLO involved and incur that cost. Then when we know what the creditworthiness is and the income, we can negotiate our terms. So if Barb the buyer doesn't have as much down payment, I might want a little higher interest rate. Or if she has poor credit, I might want more down payment. There's a little bit of balancing of the scales that we can do there when we're negotiating that transaction. And then we put the offer and acceptance in writing with earnest money. Earnest money will cover that MLO fee in case she doesn't qualify. Then the MLO will underwrite them. They'll pull a credit report for you and qualify them with their income statements. We will order a title report and do any closing contingencies. We'll set up closing, get a settlement statement. Always review your documents on a seller finance deal before you let the buyer sign, because you want to make sure there's certain clauses in there, like you also want to do on sale clause. Some people like to put a clause in there that if the buyer ever sells the property, they can have first right of refusal on it. That's kind of a cool clause. You want late fees in there, things like that. So always look at your documents before they get signed. And then we go to closing and we record and we service. So we have a class called Creating Notes Masterclass, where we go through each of these 10 steps for people that want to create the notes. And we talk about, you know, going through the pre-qualification and how to negotiate the terms. And so that's the overall how it works. And they can be very lucrative if you're wanting to do those wrap transactions. Now, I promised you that we talk more about partials. So let's do that. So think of a note like a pie. You slice up the pie, and you buy the whole pie, you slice it up, and then you sell off 4 pieces of the pie for the price of the pie. And you keep the rest of the pie. That's really what a partial is. You're just divvying up the payment stream. So in essence, a full is buying all 360 payments that Sam the seller is owed from Barb the buyer, and a partial is buying those payments for part of the time. So on a partial, we could buy, say, the next 15 years of payments, or we could buy the next 10 years of payments, or the next 5 years of payments. So let's look at an example. This was a deal we did in Texas. We like Texas because it's a non-judicial foreclosure state. When you're a note investor, you hope you never have to take a property back, that the payments come in on time every month. If they don't come in on time, you have the servicer call up, see if you can work out a payment plan. If that doesn't work, we usually offer for them to give us a deed in lieu of foreclosure back, so we can take the property back. We've even done cash for keys in those situations. None of that works. We actually have to go through foreclosure and take the property back, just like a bank would. In states that have deeds of trust, it's generally considered a non-judicial foreclosure state, and they take less time and cost less in attorney fees to get the property back. So as a note investor, a lot of people like states like Texas because they're non-judicial foreclosure states. I also buy notes in Florida. We are mortgage state. Mortgage states are judicial foreclosure, which means it costs more and takes more time. You just have to factor that in. As long as your note performs, it doesn't matter until it doesn't. right? So there's some states, not to pick on anybody in here, but if you're from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, those states, it's a really long time to foreclose, several years. So we tend to like states with shorter foreclosure times, just in case the people don't pay and we have to get the property back. So Texas had this deed of trust, seller financed. It was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house in Dallas. It sold for $60,000 with $6,000 down. So the seller carried $54,000 at a nice 11.5% interest rate for 30 years. The buyer's payment was $534.76. So the concept is I'm going to buy all of the note, and then I'm going to sell off a partial and try to get whole. So I bought this whole note for $47,500. So the seller was owed $54,000. They got $47,500. They didn't have to wait. They got it, one payment after closing. Then I collected two payments, and I sold this to another investor for $51,000. But I didn't sell the whole thing. I just sold 279 payments. So remember that this note has 360 payments on it, and I sold off 279 payments for $51,000. I bought all the payments for $47,500. So right away, there's a profit, right? So at closing, when I sold this note, I netted $3,500, and I kept 79 payments on the back end. So if I bought it $47,500, all of it, I bought the whole pie for $47,500. I sold part of the pie for $51,000. I made $3,500 on that sale of the pie. And I kept 79 payments of the pie on the back end. My investor was happy. My partial investor still got 11.75 yield on those 279 payments. So now I've got made money, got all my capital back, and I still have the right 79 payments in the future. That's what's cool about a partial. Now, what happens if the note pays off early? That happens a lot. Most notes pay off in 7 to 10 years. They don't go to 30 years. I wish they all went to 30 years. Well, in this case, you've got three balances going on with the partial. You got Barb the buyer's balance. That's column one. We call that Schedule A. That's the amount she owes on the whole note. Then you've got column B or Schedule B. That's how much the investor is owed that bought the partial. And then you have Schedule C, the third column, that's how much is left over that Sam the seller gets. So the servicer collects those payments, and every time the payment comes in, they go, oh, this much went to principal and interest for Barb the buyer. Oh, this much goes to pay down the investor. This much is left over. So when that payoff came in, what was left over, because we owned the back end, was $17,262. So I made $3,500 on the upside. The front side, got all my capital back, and then this paid off, and I got a check for $17,262. So that's cool, right? That's money on money. That's infinite return. Because, and people say, oh, I don't like notes because I want to fight inflation. I don't know any better way to fight inflation than to get your money back out of a deal and still have a cash flow coming in on it. Yeah. Okay, you had a question. Somebody over here. Yeah? So the question is, how do you do taxes on it? Depends on how you hold it, because if you're holding it outside of an IRA, then there's tax on the interest income, and you have some basis in buying the note. I like to do these deals because of the infinite return on them. I like to do these deals in a self-directed IRA because it's tax-free or tax-deferred, and I don't have to worry about that question. But if you're doing them outside an IRA, then yes, you're going to have some interest income that you have to report. The way this normally works is, I want to talk a little bit more about partials here. The way this normally works is, when we do a partial, we're not splitting up ownership of the note. And the reason we don't like to split up ownership of the note is I don't want to do anything that gets me close to creating a security out of that note. So the way I've been taught over the 30 years is you keep one note with one investor. You don't divvy up the note itself. So when we do these partials, we have a full assignment of the deed of trust or mortgage, and a full endorsement of the note to the partial investor, the person who's buying the front end of payments. So they own it, and there's a purchase agreement that says that after you collect the amount you're supposed to receive, you'll give me an assignment and a note endorsement back so I can collect those payments I'm supposed to receive. We put all of that paperwork into the third-party escrow servicer, and they handle that and keep track of all the balances. We have a list of servicers that understand partials that's in our directory, because not all servicers understand that. But we do that because we want full ownership and control of the note to be with one party and not on the other end. There's other fancy ways to do it. Some people set up a trust and they sell off a beneficial interest in the trust. There's other ways to do it. This is a simple way to do it that we've used for a long time. Yeah, you had a question in the middle. You could theoretically, but most note buyers want their payments up front and you would keep the ones on the end. But you might find somebody that would do that that's younger and they have a retirement account and they don't want any of that money until way out in the future. That would be your best buyer for those. We have institutional banks that will buy these partials. In fact, this one that I just showed you, I sold off to a bank. And so the banks always want the front end piece. Yeah, but you could do that with somebody creative thinking. Yeah.
So in this scenario you just described, could the note buyer then sell off part of what was bought to another note buyer?
So that's a wonderfully creative idea. I personally don't like you to put more than one partial buyer in a deal. It gets really messy because somebody owes somebody who owes somebody, and. So if you're going to do that, here's how I like to do it. If you have a partial, why don't you just borrow against it? Yeah.
I guess I was looking at it more from the standpoint of maybe preventing that buyer from reselling a partial.
We put a first right of refusal in all our partial agreements. So we have if they go to sell what's left, we always have the first right to meet or beat that price. Yeah, so our partial docs have first right of refusal. Really great question. Yeah.
And where does that first right of refusal get placed so that you know when they go to sell that note?
It gets placed in the purchase agreement with the servicing agent. Yeah.
And they have to agree to use the same servicing agent? Is that part of
it? We do that, yes. Yeah. All really good questions. Yeah, I'm going to take a couple more partials and I'm going to keep going. Yeah.
Is there any way you could just move one slide prior to that one?
Sure. Yeah. I can do that. That one?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks. I might have missed this, but in the case of default and foreclosure, who handles the foreclosure proceedings? Is it you or the person who bought the partial?
Great question. She said, if it doesn't pay, look, it paid off early, that's nice, but what if they don't pay? Very good question. Who's going to handle foreclosure? Normally, the party that has the full assignment and the full endorsement that's currently getting the payments is the one in charge of the foreclosure. They'll normally initiate that through the servicer because it takes an attorney to initiate foreclosure. Then they get paid their portion, and then the remainder men would get paid their portion. Most partial agreements also give the remainder person the right to step in and cure it if they want to, and they can take it over and go to foreclosure. Yeah, so partials have a lot of questions. We have partial documents we've used that we provide in our Perfecting Partials Masterclass. We always recommend you get them reviewed by your own attorney, make sure they're appropriate for your state, but it's a good place to start with a good set of partial documents. And because partials are my favorite and they take a while to explain, that's why we did a whole class on those. But I wanted people just to see the power of them. I'm going to finish through, and then we'll stay if there's more questions at the end. All right, we're going to look at two more deals, maybe, if I can talk fast. I'm going to show you another wrap deal. This was a sales price of $164,000 in Corpus Christi, Texas. The buyer made a $16,000 down payment. The seller financed $148,000. But Sam, the seller, still owed $51,532, lucky them, at 3.5%, $488 a month. They sold on a wrap, and they were owed $145,492 at 9.89%. So they're getting a payment of $1,286, and every month they have to send out $488. We were going to buy this note for $138,860, so we're going to buy the wrap note of $145 for $138, but we're going to pay off the first when we buy it. Because when Sam the seller sells me that wrap note, Sam the seller still owes the bank, so I got to take that off what I'm going to pay as a note investor. When I take that off, I can either pay off the first, or I can just keep it there and let that 3.5% ride. So either way, the seller is going to net this $87,328. If I pay off the first, I'm going to get about a 10.48 yield. That's because I bought that 9.89 interest rate at a little discount, so I get a little better yield. Remember, we talked about that earlier. And if I keep it as a wrap, I let that $51,000 ride at the bank, my yield goes up to 12%. Why? Because that $51,000 is out there financed at 3.5%. So even as a note investor, we can still play with wraps and use that power of leveraging. All right, one more example. You don't always have to do a partial. If you hate the idea of a partial and it just made your brain go blah, I understand. My husband has a funny saying. He says, I don't like math, but I like money. I happen to like math, and I happen to like money. And there are more than one ways to do deals. So if you hate partials, that's okay. You don't have to like them. You can still do notes. You can do one of two things. One way to fix the partial situation if you're creating notes is to do a first and a second. All right? Sales price of $210,000. Down payment was $18,350. That's 9% down from Barb the buyer. Barb really didn't do all these deals. We're just using Sam and Barb to keep everybody straight. Oh, she didn't put 20% down like Tracy suggested, did she? Mm-mm. That's all she could afford, 9%. So now we've got a note that's going to have a higher loan-to-value. Barb's still going to owe 91%, right? And if I want to sell that note, an investor's not going to want to be such a high loan-to-value, because remember, private investors don't get private mortgage insurance. So I could sell a partial of my note, or I could just do a first and a second. So we're going to seller finance the first at a 75% loan-to-value, still seller finance, $157,000. That's going to be at 9.5% for 30 years. Her payment will be $13.20.14 on that first position note. Now, I'm going to sell off that first position note to cover maybe my hard money lender when I bought the deal, to get my profit out of it. So I'm selling, this is a real live deal, an investor paid 97%. They paid $152,290 on that $157,000 first. That investor is very happy because they're below a 75% investment to value. This investor that created this note is very happy because they got the down payment, they got paid off, they got some profit, they also paid off their hard money loan, and they did one more thing. They kept that $34,650 as a second position note. And that pays off at 10.5% for 30 years at $316.96. So without doing a wrap and without doing a partial, they just broke the note into a first and a second. They sold the first off for top dollar, and they kept the second for cash flow right now. So they got cash now, cash later, and they get this cash flow of $316.96. So that's another way to do it if partials just make you go, ugh. All right? That's okay. So it's another, think of first and seconds. You hold the second. Here's another way to do infant return. Right? All right. So I love that for those reasons. So how do you make notes work for you? I hope you saw some ideas to look at things differently. You might want to buy a property or sell a property using owner financing. You might want to be a private lender. You might want to find a note and just refer it for a fee, like a wholesale deal. You might want to buy a note, hold it for interest income. You might want to buy a full and sell a partial. You might want to buy a note and hypothecate it. Hypothecating, it's just a fancy word for borrowing against it. You can borrow against a note like you can borrow against a piece of property. You might want to buy a non-performing note and restructure it. Those are all different ways that you can get involved in the note business. So how do you get involved? Well, when I started out in 1988, first 10 years, I did it for an institutional investor, and they were my mentor. Get to learn on their dime. In 97, my husband and I started our own note investing company, and I can honestly say I would not learn this business if somebody hadn't taught it to me. I don't know where I would have learned it. I feel lucky that I learned it. My husband was involved in the note business before I met him, and he had a different mentor, John Richards, down in California. And they were some of the original pioneers of note investing. There's always been people like Pete who bought and sold property with notes. He loves the property. There's people like me who love the notes. Why do I love notes? Because when I started out, I'll be honest, I got involved in notes because I wanted to make a living. And when I got into notes as my own investment, I did it for freedom of time. My daughter was in school, and I wanted to have time to spend with her. I wanted to work on my own time frame. And now that she's grown, then I have the time to be able to travel. I can do this note business from anywhere. And now we've entered this third stage of our life, which is really fun. And now we get to mentor other people who also want an alternative to create monthly cash flow backed by real estate without the headaches of tenants, toilets, and trash. So we feel like you need three things if you want to be a successful note investor. And that are those are tools, training, and support. And that's what we provide at Note Investing Tools. So our tools are brought into things like templates and checklists and partial documents and purchase agreements and all the things that you need, the how-to stuff, how you need to do the transaction based on all of our 60-plus combined experiences. We also give you step-by-step plans. If you want to refer a note, you have one type of action plan. If you want to create a note, you have a different kind of action plan. And if you want to invest in a note because you have cash available to do that in your retirement account, then we teach you that approach as well. And each one of those approaches has a specific training class involved with it. This is all online. It already exists. And there are videos that you can walk through each different type of training. You get lifetime access to these videos where you can log in and watch them on your own time frame. We go through Note Investing 101, calculating notes. One of my favorite things is I make the financial calculator approachable, and you'll never look at money again the same. And even if you just use this calculator course for buying and selling real estate, it's very helpful. Creating notes masterclass is for people who want to create a note out of property they own or acquire. We have the partial masterclass. That's for everybody in here who had a question on partials. We have the marketing for notes class. That's for people who want to find a note and refer it to another investor if they want to get in wholesaling notes. And those are trainings that we have available, and they're all online. And then the support aspect is my husband and myself. My husband's actually in Dallas right now. There's a big note investing conference there every year. They have them on the same weekend. I wish they wouldn't. So he's there at Note Expo in Dallas, and I'm here. So I think I won the prize because all of you lovely people here. Thanks for spending time with me today. And so he and I provide the support. And the way we provide support is we have a monthly membership that's $97 a month. And we include 6 months of that with the package here at RIA. So what is involved is you get 6 months access to our Note Mastermind community. Once a month, you get to get on a call with all your other members of the community, and a lot of people share deals of what they're doing. Some people want to create a note, some people want to sell it, some people want to invest their IRA money. We do member-only webinars that are teaching webinars, where we do live group coaching if you want that. And then we also have monthly one-on-one calls. So what we find most people have is that they learn all these great strategies, and then they go to apply them, and it doesn't quite look the way it did in training, and they have questions. And so you can bring those questions either to a group coaching call, or all our members get one one-on-one coaching call with either Fred or I, you can pick, a month. And so that's where you can talk about a deal that you just really prefer not to share with the group, or maybe you're just stuck. And then you get access to our help desk. Fred and I man this help desk. We figure that nobody can share their knowledge as well as we can. We've done this each 30 years, so 60 years combined. And so we feel like that is one of the key elements to our training, is also providing support. Because of that, we do this twice a year, in the spring and the fall, because we actually do the note business also. And so because it's just us doing the support, we try to cycle that up in the spring and the fall. And so we do have access to our member area, and this is just a sample of what that member area looks like, and how there's over 100 archived webinars that you guys get access to. It's like an MBA in notes, really. And so what we're doing here is we're also providing you that directory that I talked about, where there's note buyers and also servicers. We give you a 475-page manual if you're a person who likes to read and not watch videos. And then we give you access to online software that helps you do the calculations that the financial calculator does. And then, of course, we give you checklists. I'm a big believer in due diligence checklists. Remember, that's how I got my start. So I'm the due diligence side. My husband does a lot of the marketing side. So what we're doing here today is we're putting it all together so you get tools, training, and support. And we're doing that offer today for $979. And they have some information in the back. You can actually, if you're interested in working with us, they have the order forms there, also in the bookstore. And I want to just say that I love note investing. I love notes. I'm excited about them. Let me say, if I wouldn't still be doing it for 30 years if I didn't love them. I would have given it up, right? But I love the freedom of time it gives me. I love the freedom of creativity. And ultimately, we all want to build monthly cash flow backed by real estate. For me, that means without the headaches of tenants, toilets, and trash. So if you're interested in note investing, I welcome you to become part of the Note Investing Tools membership, and I'll be around all day. So if you have any questions, please come up and see me. And to everyone, happy note investing. Thank you.